security people and CISOs aren't great in speaking the language of the board, which is finance. And we should be able to make the risks quantifiable with a number that explains what it is that's actually a worry for the CISO and what does it mean subsequently to the enterprise when those risks would manifest.
This is KBCast.
As a primary target for ransomware campaigns,
security and testing and performance and scalability,
risk and compliance,
we can actually automate that.
Take that data and use it.
Joining me today is Jaya Bellew, Chief Security Officer from Rapid7, and today we're discussing the fog of war. So Jaya, thanks for joining and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I want to start with the US Security Exchange Commission, or also known as the SEC, will later this year implement new cybersecurity disclosure rules. So maybe for those people who are not familiar, maybe walk us through, what does this look like?
Yeah, so this is basically a notification that there was a cybersecurity incident to the SEC so that the SEC can notify, you know, stock market folks, specifically shareholders, about the nature of the companies they're investing in order to understand the risk better. That means that you do this disclosure so that shareholders aren't taking any unnecessary risks because they don't understand the cybersecurity posture or incidents at a company and thereby not, you know, exposing themselves or deciding whether or not they want to.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And I know that part of, you know, what we're doing here in Australia in terms of the mandatory data breach notification, do you think that that's sort of going to follow suit with Australia from your perspective?
I think it's going to happen from every exchange. So the nature of these types of regulations is they tend to cast a long shadow globally that everybody winds up adopting similar legislation unless there's something woefully bad. My worry that I have with the SEC regulation is that you have to notify of a breach that is considered material within 4 business days. And that's what you were alluding to with the fog of war. It's difficult when you're actually running within an incident, first of all, to figure out what the heck happened. That's already difficult. And then subsequently to determine materiality. And then once having done so, to then report within 4 days, I think we're looking at a whole bunch of things to unpack. Also, what do we define as being material? The SEC hasn't provided any guidance in terms of, is that 1% of your global revenue, or, you know, what would be material in terms of like reputation loss? Or so that I think that there's going to be a lot of nitpicking done here by all the lawyers when this actually does come into effect, because this is difficult to implement. And I think you're going to see similar challenges in different geographies, also in Australia, with these types of regulations. Because honestly, what's going to happen when you do not report this correctly? I think that there are carrots to doing this in order to say, hey, you're doing this in order to ensure a better risk understanding from shareholders. But there are going to be sticks added to it as well, with penalties and fines. And those kinds of things worry me as we progress in all of this reporting.
Okay, so there's a couple of things in there that I want to get into. What do you think is fair in terms of material? Just from your like point of view, because again, with Australia, with the fines, for example, like we obviously had massive breaches here last year, but you know, people are sort of saying like, they don't know if the fines were enough to keep people accountable, to keep people feeling that, you know, there was some type of compensation for the people that were impacted, etc. So what are your thoughts then on this, maybe having an Australian view, but also more of a global view?
Yeah, so I think fines, you know, intrinsically are there to have a sort of business case justification for why you would implement preventative security measures instead of reactively paying the fine. So in order to kind of say, hey, if you pay for cybersecurity upfront, the prevention is far cheaper than the cure of paying this fine once you would actually have an incident, not to mention the reputation loss, the outage, the loss of continuity, et cetera. And the materiality is a difficult thing to kind of pin on because, of course, it's different for every organization. For some organizations, 1% of global revenue, they can take that into account because they have different targets on what they're supposed to do in terms of revenue numbers or free cash flow, or, you know, so it's not as relevant. So because materiality is left to be determined with those companies themselves, I actually do think that this is going to be one of those sticky wickets where you are going to see a lot of back and forth between, was it actually material? Wasn't it material? Should they have reported? Should they not have reported? I think it's going to be very, very difficult. And we're going to see a lot of challenges as this actually gets implemented.
So just going back on the penalty side of things. So I obviously speak to a lot of cybersecurity people around the globe, and people sort of saying like, some of the penalties, if I focus here on in Australia, they're like, well, that's nothing for a lot of these big companies that are, you know, making billions of dollars a year. So how does that balance out then? Because it's going to be like, oh, well, you know, that doesn't cost us that much in the grand scheme of things. And going back to your point before around, of course, brand damage and things like that. But again, if we just focus on the penalties, do you think it's enough, or do you think there needs to be a higher amount, or what's your view?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a really good point. I think the first case of it, if we take a look at something like, which was a European legislation, not American, not Australian, but European, that actually really kind of had the shock and awe factor in terms of those penalties, it would be GDPR, because that was, you know, 20 million or 4% of your global revenue. And I do think that it did have that shock and awe effect initially. I think that, you know, we also talked about looking at those positions of C-level and potentially facing liability charges themselves. This, for me, is actually the greater degree. So it depends on what are we talking about penalties. Is it solely financial, or are we actually going to hold account the level of that company that actually was responsible for the decision-making of some of this stuff? So in order to ensure good practice, again, I think it's part of the overall business case of what it is you're trying to achieve, that you would try to push those penalties to say penalties are more expensive than potentially implementing those cybersecurity best practices. And I think that there is just a lack of long-term strategy when companies do not do that initial investment. And I do think there's a question of how much investment is enough in cybersecurity. The way that I try to, you know, figure that out in terms of determining what you should be spending, I have a rough number. If you look at your overall IT or tech spend, or IT and your tech spend, if you calculate roughly 10% of that to be reserved for cybersecurity, that would be great. And I can tell you, there is no company that I know now that is reserving a 10% cost of cybersecurity for their overall IT and tech spend. Nobody does that. That's a lot of money, and they just don't do it. They would rather spend it on functional development of their IT systems and their technology rather than kind of making sure that they have the preventative measures built in for cybersecurity. And I think that we should encourage more companies to kind of follow that rather than trying to figure out, how do I pay the fine when it hits me?
Okay, so really great points you've raised. So going back to the 10%, which is the ideal number, what do you think the percentage is that people are spending from your perspective, if you had to sort of guess? Or
I think on average, we'd be lucky if we'd look at 3 to 4%.
So 3 to 4%, so they're always doubling that spend. So how would you recommend people come up in that percentage? Because that is, you know, that's not like just 1% delta, like that's more than double.
Yeah, so I think it's actually accurately accounting for the fact that even when you work with vendors that are building in cybersecurity, which necessarily not always makes them the cheapest vendors, because we are very price sensitive in terms of figuring out who we work with. And we pay for the lack of cybersecurity protections in our products now, since there's not enough incentivization to have them, you know, secure by design, built in by default. So as a result of which, I think that's where the whole discussion starts. You know, what is your IT spend? Are you actually conducting that well? And then subsequently, let's say that we are price sensitive and we have legacy systems, et cetera, then we haven't been accounting for that in the past. This is why I'm suggesting that we reserve that 10%. And it's not a crazy amount. We've been throwing that number around in discussions in Europe for quite some time. If you take a look at, you know, security contracts with the large cloud providers, that's what they'll ask you for logging and monitoring. So it's not an insane number at all. But as long as we account for the fact that we are working with legacy, that we are integrating all these new technologies, a 10% spend is reasonable in order to kind of pull all of those things together in terms of configuration and long-term security.
Okay, so just going back on the points you made earlier, Jaya, around there is a lack of long-term cybersecurity strategy being implemented in organizations. Why do you think that's the case?
I think it's really because, first of all, it's difficult. It's, first of all, we shouldn't make it sound like it's easy and it's the basics. It is not. It is difficult. So that's the first reason not to have a long-term strategy, because usually that security strategy is accompanying an overall strategy. So if there's no long-term overall strategy for technical and IT and, you know, other types of technology-driven decision-making, it's difficult to put a security strategy on top of that. Then suddenly that does have to be long-term, because it would mean that it would discount or be in place of some of those other strategies that should have been there. So that's the first reason, because we're not seeing that long-term vision in everything else. It's hard to pin a long-term security strategy on the absence of that. And then subsequently, even when you have this, you know, longer-term technical vision, then the security strategy part of that means that you would first and foremost know thyself. A lot of companies have a hard time understanding their current footprint, their critical assets, their overall inventory of internal assets, and defining things around security that they kind of should know. That's hard because organizations have grown both organically and in some cases with mergers and acquisitions. So they're at a state where it's hard for them to know every single IP address, every single device, every single MAC address. You know, it's hard for them to understand that landscape. And then subsequently taking it from this know thyself perspective to being able to do all of their logging and monitoring and visibility and everything else, that's also equally difficult. And then finally, being able to act with some level of agility to the problems that they're seeing, that is in a real-time scenario difficult, but then imagine trying to plan this out for 2 or 3 years. So understanding what it is do I have, what is it that I want to be able to see, and then how am I able to be in a state where I can actually deflect and block all of those threats. So from those three perspectives, it's hard to build a strategy that would encompass all of that for all these new technologies.
Okay, so let's get back on the 10%, because this is really interesting. So if you're a CISO or head of security and you're like thinking, well, I'm spending between 3 or 4% on average, but I want to get it to 10%. If you take it to a CFO and say, hey, I want to double plus a bit more my spend, how do you think a CFO is going to react? Because a lot of the time, cybersecurity people aren't great at pitching why they should get more, you know, money for cybersecurity, etc. Because these things, you can't really see the spend going anywhere. If you didn't get breached, that's great. Whereas when you go and buy a nice fancy office fit out, you can actually see where all the money went. So how do you think that conversation goes internally?
Yeah, by the way, this is an excellent question. Thank you for asking it, because the issue is, I call this return on security investment. Security people and CISOs aren't great in speaking the language of the board, which is finance. And we should be able to make the risks quantifiable with a number that explains what it is that's actually, you know, a worry for the CISO, and what does it mean subsequently to the enterprise when those risks would manifest. So a couple of years ago, we developed something called the FOSI calculator, which is a potential harm of security incident, so PHOSI, and it's available open source online. It's in an app called the KPN CISO app. It has policies, et cetera. But the point is that that's there to try to make security people speak that language of the board and to understand the risks they take when they have security exceptions or when they have security incidents, and they understand what the value of that incident is subsequent to the value of the mitigation. And if you take all of these potential harm of security incidents and you add them up, then you'll know like what the sigma is for all of those potential harm things that a security team would have been able to, you know, hopefully block and tackle and eliminate as a threat. And that's their actual value contribution to the business, because it's not top line revenue growth, but bottom line revenue retention. And this is really important, because this is the value that security brings to the organization. The fact that they can hold on to their revenue, that is a big deal. The fact that it isn't being taken away by a ransomware gang, because there is a team that has worked tirelessly on strategies to make sure that detection and response are there, that we have backup strategies, that we have defense in depth programs. So this is the value contribution. It is revenue retention. And, you know, again, we have to be disciplined in making that visible, because what happens to a regular security company? Usually there's a breach or an incident, and the security team starts riding like the roller coaster, where they kind of ride the roller coaster up because they suddenly have budgets. They suddenly are allowed to hire more people. You know, there is an attention from the board and the rest of their peers in terms of asking them, how should we solve security? That happens after an incident. And as they ride the roller coaster up, and this team is now accrued tooling and people and strategies and things are in place in the organization, that team begins delivering on that promise. And inevitably, but surely, if they're not reporting back on this value that they're giving the enterprise, they ride the roller coaster inevitably back down. They lose slowly but surely the next time that there is a target on the business. They lose a couple of FTE, then they lose a little bit of budget because everybody has to cut budgets and so does the security team. And they ride the roller coaster all the way back down to a point where they're again waiting for the next breach to happen in order to ride the roller coaster back up. And frankly, this is super silly, but we've seen this cyclical effect over and over again. And it makes no sense because we know that we need to get off of this roller coaster by actually demonstrating that value. And only then can we actually prove what we are delivering in a consistent way and actually protect that enterprise.
Okay, so there was something interesting that you said there, hold on to the revenue. Would you say that CFOs, if you focus on them for a moment, they're very focused on top line revenue? Well, how do we generate more revenue? Or how do we cut costs? Do you think that, going back to your point you made earlier, holding on to the revenue and revenue retention, do you think that's something that people are not paying attention to and it just gets absorbed by everything else that gets sort of discussed in board meetings, for example?
But I think it's the onus or the burden of the security team to make that revenue retention number, what they're contributing to it, visible. So I don't think that the CFO has a responsibility to figure that out on their own. Neither does the board. I think that's actually the job of the security team. We need to make visible what our contribution is to the rest of the enterprise.
Okay, this is a really great point. Would you say, from your experience, people forget why they're there in the first place? Because, I mean, I've spoken to people at length about this. Sometimes in the past, people forget that they're there to protect an organization. And some people think, well, I'm just here to practice security all day, which is fundamentally not true. But again, it goes back to the overall vision. As a security function inside an organization, your job is to protect that organization and their customers and the data, etc. But do you think people lose sight of that perhaps?
They might. It's hard for me to say because this is my third job as a CISO. So I've been a CISO for slightly over 11 years. And I have to tell you that every time I enter a new organization, I start with a vision, a mission, an objectives, a strategy, and an action plan that's aligned to the overall corporate vision, mission, objective, strategy, action plan. So it has to be the same story in the sense that it's aligned. But I think that it's very much top of mind for me to, from the get-go, explain what is it that we're here to do and why, really starting with the why in order to explain that value-driven approach to security. Because I think otherwise you're just cannibalizing your own capability if you don't show that proof of value.
So from your point of view, do you have any insights on what does the why look like in just in some of your previous roles or organizations you've gone into? Is there anything you can share that may inspire someone that perhaps isn't sharing with their organization the why?
Well, so I think it starts with what kind of organization are you? You know, why are you in this security team in the first place? Did this organization just suffer a breach? Are you coming in because there's a regulatory requirement to have a security function? You know, so starting by asking yourself, like, why am I here? What is the thing that I am meant to do on this earth for this company? That is absolutely the right starting point. But I think it's very contextual to the org that you're working for. So my first CISO role was 7 years working for a piece of national critical infrastructure, which was a telco in the Netherlands. And so that why became really clear. I was their first CISO after an enormous breach by a 15-year-old kid. So again, there, the why was written on the wall. So it was relatively easy to make this mission to defend KPN for customers, partners, and society at large. And then the second CISO job that I got was with Avast. Avast is an antivirus vendor, and they are amazing. They have over 500 million customers worldwide, and they were providing AV because they believed that security was a fundamental right for everyone and not just those companies that could afford it, which I think is a beautiful mission in general. So it became, the mission at Avast became defending the defenders. If I make sure that Avast is secure, they can help secure everybody else. So with 500 million clients, it became a really beautiful thing to try to do to help all of those people stay secure. And then now that I'm CISO of Rapid7 since this year, it's very much a notion of, you know, we use our own products. We drink our own champagne. So we really have to make sure that those products are our best of class, that our customers can give us unwavering trust, because there shall be no supply chain threat coming from Rapid7, because we are foundationally secure. So it, you know, the mission is very dependent on where are you sitting. That determines a lot on where you stand on all of these issues.
Okay, so let's get back onto maybe cost of a breach, not necessarily the numbers, but more so the thinking behind it. I mean, I was talking to someone literally yesterday about this, and I was saying, I don't know if companies are thinking through, like, if they had a ransomware attack, on how much that would cost if they can't leverage their systems to do anything, to pay their people, etc. But then also to your point before about brand damage, and this is something that is very hard for people to answer, but if you look at, I mean, the breaches in Australia last year, for example, if you look at their stock, it plummeted. It was very, very hard that week. And I don't know where it sits today, but I think that's just an example of the overall issues with a breach. But then the question I'm sort of getting at here, Jaya, is what about the long-term impacts then of getting those customers back or acquiring new ones? Do you think anyone has any sort of numbers or any sort of insight on this? Because it's something that I've been trying to cover. And again, I'm not saying it's an easy answer and it's not necessarily a, you know, a yes or a no, black and white sort of response, but it's just more so the thinking behind it, which I think goes back into why we should be trying to get that 3-4% budget up to the 10%.
Yeah, so I have some thinking around this, and that's really because I think we look at two things. So when you look at, you know, very specific direct cost impact, you're looking at what was the cost of the forensics teams that I hired? What was the cost of the employee hours that I ran during the incident? What was the cost of not being available for those hours? Maybe potential loss of sales that would have been normally conducted at that point, you know, last year when we had that, when we had continuous service. So I think you have a lot of direct cost impact, which is more measurable, but indeed there are the indirect costs, which is brand and reputation loss, other types of potential regulatory oversight, which initially cannot be directly measured if there's no preordained fine or something else, and you don't know that in advance, you might have to deal with that later. And there's also legal fees, et cetera, that would all come about later, subsequent to that, and that would still be a direct cost, but you would only know them after the fact. So I think that we need to examine this from direct versus indirect cost exposure. You can do that with the potential harm of a security incident, but it will not be an exact number because it was more meant to have this rolling number and forecast for your internal team rather than be able to have this predictive force for all incidents. And I do think it's about us being able to levy that direct and indirect cost thinking in all of our strategies for alleviating any particular type of threat. So if we have a really good example, you know, there's been a couple of them in recent days. We had the ransomware, you mentioned ransomware yourself. There was a couple of ransomware breaches with MGM and Caesars, which was a global attack because there were, you know, lack of connectivity for their hotels in the Philippines, et cetera, all over Asia. And I was thinking of a different hack because there was also a ransomware attack of Clorox, which then subsequently, which is the cleaning brand, but subsequently they couldn't stock shelves with their cleaning products because of their ransomware breach. So their direct cost impact was both the cost of the incident itself plus the cost of loss of sales because they couldn't shelf products and they had to do an SEC notification as well as report to their customers. So I think we're looking in this new realm where this disclosure is there because there is such a strong financial impact. Because cybersecurity is just one of the things that guarantees regular business operations, that I believe that our regulatory frameworks are going to get even tighter, not looser. So we need to calculate that cost in as well. So an additional indirect cost.
Yeah, those are great points. And I like your way of thinking about it. Because again, it's something that maybe people need to put more of a focus on, which could change the conversation to that 3-4% to the 10%. But I want to focus on the indirect cost. So just hypothetically, let's use MGM, for example. How does a company try to measure? I mean, I don't know, maybe you need some actuarialist or someone to model this out around, well, we've had this breach, all the direct costs that you just mentioned and rattled off, which makes sense, but the indirect costs are, well, now they've had that breach, are they going to be down, I don't know, 50% customers because people don't want to go in there because of the breach or they've lost trust or Those are the things I think is going to be really hard to forecast because I guess how long's a piece of string? So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that front?
Well, I think it depends, right? I mean, the question is, what is that service and how likely is a cybersecurity breach likely to affect the service that's associated with it? So let's be honest, we also saw major data breaches at other hotel chains. And I think that we need to think about what does that mean? Does that mean that you no longer want to give your credit card to a hotel? You know, sometimes they demand your passport. Sometimes they make copies of your passport. So I think the identity theft data breach thing, and they also like the data retention perspective, why do they hold on to this data forever? If they only need it initially, they shouldn't keep it for 6 years, et cetera. They should actually get rid of the data that they're collecting from you as a hotel guest. And I think this kind of behavior can only be motivated appropriately enough when customers actually do stop using these services because there was a cybersecurity breach. As long as we still have them using it despite those breaches, I don't think we're going to change any behavior, but it's highly context-driven. I would argue that the harsher scorn from a user of a service or things, it's more clear examples when it's a medical healthcare institute or whether it's banking, because obviously the type of data exposure at those type or credit, I'm thinking of Equifax. So I think when we have those types of data exposure, it's much more directly linked to cybersecurity and the product, which you then wouldn't want to use. But when it's more indirect or non-core business direction, then I think what you wind up seeing is customers are not thrilled, but they will accept that loss of privacy and security in order to still make use of the product. And that's a shame. And that behavior needs to change. We need to hold companies much more accountable for the fact that everything is automated and online. And thereby, they need really good practices to make sure that they're ensuring customer trust all along that process.
Okay, so you raise a great point about holding companies accountable for if they have a data breach, for example. Now, we talked a little bit at the start around the penalties, but again, to my point, like people are saying, we don't know if that's enough. How else can a company be held accountable? Because this is the thing that I've spoken about a lot on this show is, hypothetically, a breach happens, a company comes out, we're sorry, we made a mistake, we're doing this to fix it. But then who keeps them accountable? Then who follows them up in 6 months to say, well, you said this, John, are you still continuing on with that quest or how's that going? Like I just think that I have seen in the past a lot of virtue signaling. So how do we keep people accountable and on track with what they say they're going to do?
Well, here, let me offer some thoughts on this because I think there's a way not to do it, certainly. So I don't know if you saw the stories around SolarWinds and around Uber, but both were hacked. And what you saw, look, with Uber, the case of the CISO was the CISO was subsequently litigated for something else. This was a breach and he did things that he shouldn't have. So, you know, that I think that was more justified because he was doing things that a normal CISO probably wouldn't do and decisions that he wouldn't have made. But what's interesting to note is the CISO was held accountable and held liable and subject to prosecution, but the CEO was not. So it was only the CISO in the case of Uber. And in the case of SolarWinds, the people who they're holding accountable for the fact that SolarWinds was hacked by the Russians and did not have the best security practices is the one person who probably was trying to actually enact those good processes. So there were Wells notices, which means a follow-up on litigation, issued to the CISO of SolarWinds as well as the CFO. And I think what you should not do is hold accountable that person who's actually trying to get security in order across the enterprise. And, you know, it might not be working because of product or technology or IT, and there might be failures there. But the one person who's actually trying to fix it should probably not be the person you prosecute, with the absence, again, of the CEO. So I think that we need to actually hold a different set of folks accountable for the financial resources that's been given to the CISO maybe, or the lack of cooperation or interaction between CISO and IT. I think that bears further investigation. But it really makes no sense to me to go after the people who are actually trying to fix the problem unless they are woefully negligent in their duties and not trying to fix it at all. That makes no sense. So I agree with accountability, but then it should be better and more evenly spread rather than like this incorrect direction of the chief security officers.
Okay, that's really interesting. And okay, so my mind's going, so you said evenly spread. How do you evenly spread it? Should everyone just get fired? Should everyone be personally held accountable? What does that look like in your eyes? Because I mean, I think I covered this story about a year ago on that Uber breach.
Mm-hmm.
And now it was like, well, people are going to be held personally liable, which is a really big problem financially for people. And then there were conversations of this, if this comes to Australia, well, what does that look like? I mean, that's a separate problem.
Yeah.
But going back to my original question, what are your thoughts on that? How do we evenly spread some of the weight?
Well, so I think that this is more of a board question. So both the board of management as well as the supervisory board, if you have a two-tier board rather than a one-tier board, I think there's a board responsibility for this. And by the way, it's quite rare still that the CISO is on the board. The CISO is usually like a sort of functionary and adjacent to the IT and the tech stack and responsible, you know, for making sure that cybersecurity gets done, but is not always on the board, or at least I haven't seen it often enough. So I think the first and foremost thing is to make sure that that's where that even spread is. The people who are capable of allocating financial resources and making sure that the CISO is well equipped to carry out and execute the function, that those should like be held accountable. And then subsequently, if you have a CISO that is not performing, there's also a certain degree of responsibility with management to make sure that you have one that is. So I think that there's a wider, broader responsibility and more shoulders that bear this overall task than only the chief security officer. That being said, I think that when it comes to Australia, what I think I would pay attention to is, again, like, are there fines for closures, for breaches? It actually creates a perverse incentivization not to report if you then know that you're going to kind of carry a reporting burden, but also a potential litigation burden. I also think it has also far more direct impacts on chief security officers wanting to have D&O insurance, you know, insurance as a director of the company in order to pay legal fees potentially. It also demotivates people from ever want to occupy the role. So I think there's going to be some far-reaching impacts beyond the immediate and direct ones.
Yeah, this is where it gets so interesting because I'm looking at it from all angles. Like as you're speaking, I'm going through it in my mind. So let's get back onto being personally liable. Would you say with your experience that's reasonable or unreasonable? Now, it depends on who it is, but I'm just saying generally, just say hypothetically, one person had to be accountable for that personally. Do you think that's fair or unfair?
Well, we know it's unfair, right? Because this one person didn't create the security vulnerability in some random server that some other team is managing somewhere. It didn't make sure that that was not found and didn't make sure that it was not fixed. So I'm just pointing out like one very specific issue. Obviously, there's a myriad of things that can go wrong that would contribute to a breach. But I'm trying to point out that how can you ever hold one person accountable when we know that when security goes wrong, it's usually a systemic failure? It's not one issue. It's multiple issues that were all kind of failing at the same time in order for it to go so wrong that you actually have an attacker that isn't noticed. Look, like I always talk about the statistic of the fact that it takes us so long for us to even detect that an attacker is on our network. On average, it still takes about 212 days. And that's down from a number that used to be 287 days. How can that ever be resolved to saying that you hold one person accountable? That makes no sense to me. That, you know, already shows you that if an attacker has been around your network that long, then there's a whole bunch of things that failed and never can be redirected to just a single person.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But then people would argue and say, well, you know, when there was an issue with a company and a CEO gets fired, they're like, well, that seems reasonable then. So I guess it's just more so looking at it at all different angles, because that goes back to your original point around, you know, holding companies accountable. Is this what people want to see, though?
Yeah. So let me be clear. When I was suggesting that, you know, the CEO be held accountable, I was trying to suggest that if it was only the CISO that's being held accountable, where was the CEO in all this? So I'm suggesting a broader sense of liability than ever any single person. And the CEO, if they set the direction and set the budget and said, this is what we're spending and this is what I promised shareholders on the amount of money that we need to return, you know, arguably, even the CEO is working together with their board to get those numbers back to those analysts for this is our expectation on margin and revenue. We're going to make our numbers and therefore we need to cut costs. And one of those places is security. So if the CEO is setting that direction and then subsequently leads to a foundational deficiency in the capability of security to execute on their task, then yeah, they should be held accountable. But that's usually part of like this weight of the CEO. But even then, the CEO isn't acting alone. So all I'm asking for is a broader sense of responsibility than ever any single person.
And yeah, you're right, 100%. It's not one person's responsibility to be focused on, like the CISO, for example. Like that's, you know, could be unfair if they've got like a team of 500, 1,000 people. It's not always that one person's fault. But then going back to this personally liable situation, the other problem that this thing creates is, well, who's going to want to take that role as a CISO if they're going to be personally liable and that everything has to start and stop with them when there's 500 people in their team, which they might be responsible for? So there's going to be a deterrent then. We're trying to get people into the industry, but right now it seems like we're doing the opposite.
Yeah, and I think, you know, don't forget that regulatory burden, that is a significant thing. And you know that good security isn't about compliance checking the box. It's about actually getting operational things right. So I would argue that, you know, when you try to get those operational things right and you're not just doing compliance checking the boxes, like this incentivization from this regulatory perspective is to drive more compliance orientation and less operational security. So I think that we need to be really careful about how we set people up also here, you know, with all kinds of incentivizations, not to enter the industry, not to actually focus on good security, actually to motivate them to do only the box ticking exercise, because that covers them and say, oh, look, I've done everything right. It says that on this paper. And that's not what the kind of behavior we want to drive, not in our new future cybersecurity workforce and not in our companies.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think the other side of it is, well, if we're doing all this, it just seems counterintuitive then, because it doesn't seem like we're doing things for the right reasons, or now we're feeling stressed because we've got all these regulatory things we need to address and compliance. And if we're, you know, even looking at the personally liable side of things, like that's your own personal stress and burden you've got on your shoulders. So, and look, I kind of understand where people are coming from, like governments in particular. But again, if we don't enforce like some of the penalties, then I guess people don't take it seriously. And then, I mean, I don't know. I think there's just, depending on which way you look at it, I feel there's always just going to be a problem.
I think you may be right.
I think it's hard to win in this.
It is. And that's why I always like to say that CISOs have a really hard job. It is a really difficult job. They're often, you know, left holding the bag, trying to address all of the different requirements from their boards, from their teams, solving really complex challenges. And there was a wonderful tweet the other day from the director of director of the NSA's technical teams, Rob Joyce. And he basically said, have you hugged your CISO today? Because I do think that, you know, CISOs have a hard job, but we don't support them enough. And we need to get our security teams also in a slightly better position in the company, because they're not always the favorite parts of the company. If they're saying, nope, you can't go live with a particular thing before you test it first. Nope, you have to fix these vulnerabilities before you do anything else. Nope. You know, so they often are wind up in this court of being like the sort of negative, no saying thing and not always looking at solutions and opportunities, because they kind of have been put in that role to be the kind of conscience of the rest of the company. So I think that you know, supporting them, giving them a little bit more love makes their job easier, but also makes the company, as a result of it, healthier.
So where do you think we go from here, Joe? Where do you think things are going to end up? Now, I know we've spoken today a lot about, you know, penalties and fines and, you know, regulatory stuff, but what do you see from this point on moving forward?
Yeah, so I think, by the way, that we're going to live with this for at least the next 5 to 10 years. What I'm just suggesting is if we report, we should see the benefits of reporting. So we should be able to have sort of industry standards on if things go wrong, where do they go wrong? So there was recently released like a top 10 misconfigurations thing, you know, like where we were looking before at top 10 OWASP stuff. And I think we need to kind of pay attention to what those things are, what level of effort that's required from these organizations to fix it. And really not just think about doing things right and doing them well, because we're very often stuck in that mode, but also think about, are we actually doing the right things to address security? Because if that's really the case, I wonder if all of the models that we're currently going to see and the types of regulatory frameworks that are going to be bounced around the entire planet like GDPR was, even though it started in Europe, everyone suddenly started following GDPR. I think that we're going to see this global impact from even regional regulation. And I think we need to kind of brace ourselves for that. And I think we need to figure out, again, are we doing the right things? And how can we influence change to make sure we are? Not just, oh, yet another regulation. Let me just go ahead and implement that one too, because that's the modus that we're stuck in today.
So is there anything specific, Jaya, you'd like to leave our audience with today? Any closing comments or final thoughts?
Yeah, I realize this may sound a bit negative, but I'm actually pretty positive about cybersecurity because I see so many incredibly dedicated, smart, initiative, resourceful people working in this industry that I do think that we can make a significant difference. I just think that we need to coalesce and come together. And I actually think that despite those two, you know, quite significant breaches that Australia has had, I'm very positive about its future. There's going to be that new cybersecurity strategy coming out. And at this moment, I'm seeing the Australian government in pretty much every conference I go to, both in the US and in Europe. And that's very encouraging. So I really believe that looking towards the future, it can only get better from here.
This is KBCast, the voice of cyber.
Thanks for tuning in. For more industry-leading news and thought-provoking articles, visit kbi.media to get access today.
This episode is brought to you by Merksec, your smarter route to security talent. Merksec's executive search has helped enterprise organizations find the right people from around the world since 2012. Their on-demand talent acquisition team helps startups and mid-sized businesses scale faster and more efficiently. Find out more at merksec.com today.